What's the date today? Friday the 12th. All right. Well, hi, everyone, and welcome to Designers for Learning. This is our sixth episode in the series so far. Today is April 12th, and I'm very happy, to have with me, bringing back the band, Robert Squires. Robert and I did, well, I think you did at least, 30 webcasts on EdTech Talk on a webcast series called Instructional Design Live.
Yeah.
And then life called. What did you get, a new job, I think, or something like that? And
we talk about doing things like that again, and you know, our focus these days, and you know my colleague Marlene Zentz as well, has been on accessibility. So we might be doing some webcasting on accessibility in the near future, which would be interesting.
Excellent. And Robert and I did, what was it, maybe 3 years ago now. My gosh, I can't believe it. But back in that time, webcasting was quite an ordeal, right? You had to take a webcast academy, and you needed to know how to stream, and there were virtual audio cables. Well, now Google makes it. You just click a button and you're a webcaster.
This is great. And I love the feedback to the EdTech Talk site as well. That works really well.
It is
so
awesome.
So I don't have my, I'm on a different computer and I didn't have cookies enabled. So I can't see the chat in the other room. So if there's questions that are coming in through there, just shout them out, and I'll I can pick them up that way.
Sure thing. We've got, fortunately, Peggy George. I need a shout out to her. She's kind of
Peggy,
the number one fan. She shows up every week. She's more regular basically than I am. So thank you, Peggy. And so she's checking our audio and getting links dumped in there. But I invited Robert because kind of continuing my theme of looking at how people are going beyond the MOOC, I guess, to talking to folks about different applied learning applications that they're using, practical learning, experiential learning. I thought it would be great to tap into what Robert's doing, and if you want to give us a bit of an update on your background and what you're doing right now. But your official title is what? Director of Instructional Design and Technical Support at University of Montana at UM Online, right?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
Fill us in. What does that mean?
Well, you know, our team is behind the learning management system on a technical basis, although we outsource our hosting, and we're also behind the design of the online learning experiences, working with faculty closely to create those kinds of experiences that are meaningful and rewarding. So we have a team of two instructional designers, as well as myself, and then an extended kind of technical team that focuses on the Moodle side. I have to say, one of the most exciting things that we've done recently is move more into production, and we're very fortunate to have a wonderful media arts program at the University of Montana, and so we've hired a number of graduate media arts students and formed the Innovation Studio, we're calling it.
Oh, wow.
And really work at, you know, creating a web-based type experience within Moodle to make it as attractive and as easy to navigate as possible, as well as kind of address some of those powerful learning opportunities. So that's kind of, you know, our extended team. And I mentioned accessibility and webcasting just before. We also have a computer science student who is more or less blind, who focuses ourselves on a whole different aspect to innovation and how to make those experiences, you know, visually appealing, of course, but also functional for individuals using assistive technologies. So it's incredibly dynamic to get those students together and start brainstorming ideas about what, you know, this learning experience can be. Because a lot of those, especially media arts students, live in that realm.
So are you telling me, Robert, instructional design for online learning is more than making a video and having a quiz?
Is there more to it
than that?
Yeah. Well,
no.
Yes, interesting.
You would never guess it. Where all the money's going, it sounds like that's where it's at. So.
Yeah, you know, and that's interesting. The conversations on MOOCs on our campus have really been, well, I think broadly misunderstood in terms of it being something that we need to be doing because it's out there and it's being done from a kind of our perhaps our Board of Regents perspective. You know, the idea that you could deliver one thing with one person to many and therefore reduce the need for duplication of courses mm-hmm. is, you know, financially appealing. But, you know, it comes down to the quality of that experience again. And, you know, there's definitely value in being able to pick and choose those elements that you want and you know, construct your education as you would please. But it's certainly not a one-size-fits-all type of solution. Yeah, it raises some new territories for people to think about.
Yeah, I was talking to Dave Cormier not too long ago, and he and I really kind of on the same page that the MOOCs as they're being delivered right now are to me more comparable to a textbook where it's content. You know, it's a fancy way to deliver content versus right. what you're talking about with some of the other things, which is the instructional piece that kind of wraps around it. And
right.
So that to me, again, is why we're doing this. This is the far more interesting conversation of what's happening. And so can you just give us an understanding of what types of classes you're offering? And are you mainly an undergrad programs for online, or is it graduate programs, or kind of a mix?
Mostly graduate. Okay. We have about five online degrees. We have, which isn't huge compared to some other providers. We have a number of certificates. We have some non-credit courses that we're starting to do online. We have minors in different areas. And it is possible for an extremely motivated undergraduate student to take care of their general education credits online, but there's no clear pathway for them to do that. But really be focused on graduate online degrees because those students are typically better able to manage, you know, their own learning. I think that there's the potential for us to do more in the undergraduate area, but that's been our focus traditionally.
So as you're saying, you're kind of getting more into the, I would call it consulting then, versus just, and I say just, yeah. not just the technical side, but the kind of branching into the other area of the consulting with the faculty as they're bringing their courses online. That was what you said is kind of the next phase that you're working
well,
on.
Well, that's what we've been doing for some time. We've okay. shifted from a period where we were rapidly growing to having a very, I guess patterned way of taking the faculty through. We'd have a 6-week online course which faculty would take with us, and then we'd have a series of milestones across the semester that, you know, in order to get their course ready and be designed in line with our version of Quality Matters kind of course standards. We just work with them closely over that semester. And I remember, you know, working on something like 20 online courses over a semester. But given where we are just now, and it's kind of interesting, despite, you know, the general growth, we're at a point that we've subsidized our growth from our state support budget, that we can't grow at the same level that we once did. And so we've moved much more to a one-on-one instructional design to faculty support model and bringing in those Innovation Studio folks to help, you know, once we've considered the pedagogical aspects of it, consider how we can make this experience as interactive as, you know, use of social media, perhaps mobile applications and various other technologies.
So that part's really interesting to me. I'm working with students this semester in a consulting skills class for instructional designers. So they would be doing, presumably once they graduate, they'd be moving into a role like you're discussing where they're working with faculty, and whether it's face-to-face or online. So can you kind of walk us through what that process is like? And as you said, it's sort of evolved from being, you know, kind of a packaged approach to now a little bit more one-on-one, tailored, mm-hmm. sounds like, to what the you know, more of a like I said, consulting relationship with sure. you know, the faculty members. So what is that process like, and how has that changed in terms of what does the work product look like when you're done, what the class actually looks like?
Well, I mean, it's a really good point. The thing with our university, and I don't think we're unique for a public land-grant institution, is that we don't have any teeth in the instructional design area to say that this is a go yeah. or not. It's actually the departments who forward those courses. And so there was some pushback in certain areas from our kind of more methodological approach, mm-hmm. Steadily taking people through a series of steps in order to get, and nobody likes to be trained. So, the one-to-one kind of relationship approach where it's understood that all new online course developments or all new blended course developments, and we've just really began to move in that direction as well, are assigned an instructional designer to work with them on that process. And we typically ask the departments let us know a semester in advance so we can, provide the support across that period of time. But that doesn't always work either. So we do our best to, take who's coming in with their level of expertise, and, that's grown considerably over the last few years as well. And create that course that is basically it comes from them and it builds upon their levels. So we now have instructors that are incorporating case studies that are using some different rubrics to evaluate educationally valuable talk in their discussions. Mm-hmm. Individuals who are coming up with different options using a universal design kind of perspective, but it's usually the case that there's a semester or so, and maybe more, in terms of getting their feet wet with the actual course experience, mm-hmm. and understanding that we'll be here, it's a process, we all learn by experience. So we give them the opportunity to learn how they want to do that as well.
So this is really interesting to me, and the part that really gets me excited. It's exactly like you've said, and I was reading something that Bonnie Stewart wrote today talking about her first online experience, I think she said 13 years ago, where it's kind of like you just throw everybody into an LMS, and then there's some type of vague introduction through sharing profiles and bios, and then there's some type of asynchronous chit-chat. It kind of follows a little format, but then as you're saying, as the instructor gets more familiar and comfortable, then you kind of branch out and try different strategies and try different things that you don't automatically think are possible in an online environment. So kind of on that continuum, what are you seeing then? People are trying and pushing the envelope on that higher experience level as they've been doing it for a while. How are things evolving?
That's a really good question. I guess part of the way that we've looked at this is how to design the most rewarding experience possible. And so being able to sit with that faculty and understand exactly what their needs are for their class, and having that individual trust us and be able to, think through, well, maybe in this particular class there's a need for some compelling video. Mm-hmm. And yes, this kind of video, you and I, this is still very common, in terms of an instructional course. And actually, in some courses, it's. I'm glad that they would incorporate something like this. I mean, it's a step in that direction. But moving more into the production value of, we have a beekeeping course, which is fascinating, by the way.
Oh, wow.
and a non-credit beekeeping course. And, okay. And the part of it's online, and then actually you go and you do the work with the bees at the hive. But we have the instructor kind of using After Effects to produce the video. The instructor kind of, who's this really buff guy? I mean, he's good looking fellow, up on one side of the screen, and then, you know, the some information or pieces displaying as he's speaking. And that kind of packaging of the experience gets those students into that learning moment, as a colleague of mine likes to call it. And then, you know, the opportunities to interact and be engaged can sometimes spin off from there. But that's one example that, and I think that's one example, going back to the idea of MOOCs, that's often missed, that there's a lot of, I had an opportunity to attend something that Keith Devlin from Stanford was presenting about one of his MOOCs. He's a math professor, and he, you know, basically was teaching that course face to face, and it was like his question was, how do I translate this into a MOOC? And it's like, if you come at it like that, then you're going to Yes, you're going to produce those kind of content to person types of strategies. But if it comes from that idea of how do we as a team create the best possible experience and get those students in the moment when they're there at their computer, then you come at it with that ability to just get all that baggage out of the way and come at this anew and create some new experiences. So there's more use of RSS feeds. There's more incorporation of social media channels. There's a lot more focus on iBooks these days. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is, of course, they only work on Apple devices. So we have an enterprising student who's come up with the way to use Corona SDK. It's a development tool to and actually incorporate Creative Suite to come up with a workflow to create these books that work on all platforms. And as a supplementary instructional component that students can access outside of their primarily face-to-face course, it's a very nice option. But again, it comes from thinking about what this can be rather than how do I do this in this other place.
Yeah, and I think it's exactly, we used to call in my program, we would call what you described the kind of the shovelware, where I've got all the face-to-face lecture, so help me shovel it online.
Right.
You know, my lectures are recorded or whatever it may be. And I think as I'm, just from my perspective, watching how the learning curve of online learning is going, it just seems people are now getting much more aware of the importance of the active learner practice. Mm-hmm. And I'm coming up, as you're saying, the beekeeping class is a classic example where there would have been a time, I think maybe even people now would say, you can't teach a beekeeping class online, because how are they going to have a chance to touch the bees? And it's like, well, you can have both. You
right,
can
exactly.
have it where you have content and some type of interaction in the asynchronous space, and then you can have roll in some type of practice opportunity live somewhere, whether it be on the campus or if you're doing it in your other area. So to me, that's really the cool piece of it is watching people kind of realize that it's not just asynchronous and it's not just web conferencing, that you can get outside the standard ideas of practice.
Yeah, you know, and one cool thing about that beekeeping piece is that they'll actually, they're planning on embedding a camera within the beehive itself. So you'll get to witness what it looks like from inside the hive, which is, you know, just fantastic and not something that you could ever do physically or face to face. So there's always those new dimensions if you begin to kind of play with that and keeping the learner in mind what is going to be powerful for them. And you listen to people's stories about in any academic field, individuals who are passionate about their subjects, and it's that inspiration that comes out in that face-to-face contact that, you know, it's really powerful in a kind of lecture kind of way. But it's how to do something, how to bottle that inspiration and make that available online, I think is, and that's different, is what it's about.
So tell us more. I cut a couple threads that I wanted to touch in our remaining time here, but I'm very interested in talking about the Innovation Studio and how that came to be, because in and of itself, that's kind of a neat instructional design approach to include the students as kind of working professionals, right?
Yeah,
that's their job. And then also just wanted to touch on where you think the field needs to focus have in terms of curriculum for instructional designers. What are kind of the key areas that you're either not seeing people well-skilled in or you're kind of seeing around the corner we need to work on? So let's kind of take one at a time. So from the Innovation Studio piece, how did that come to be? Was that just by need, that you just had a need for this and then you went out and looked for it, or what?
You know, it came about through some conversations. I mean, we have a space that we'd use for faculty support, you know, a typical kind of room where we'd come and we'd, you know, do little kind of workshops or discuss different ideas. And we wanted to kind of reshape that, remodel that, make it something much more exciting. And, you know, around that time, well, maybe actually a little bit before, we'd hired as our academic affairs director the director of media arts. So there's actually two directors, myself of the instructional design and technical support side, and Rick Hughes, our director of academic affairs. And so Rick brings, as the former chair of media arts, all of those contacts and experience. And so, you know, we got talking about what this could be, but those students come because they know what a fantastic opportunity it is to be able to work with, you know, professionals that are exploring, you know, different ways to engage in learning. And and yes, it doesn't hurt that it's the department chair or someone who's great inspiration himself. Right. And he's a wonderful person, very down to earth, but inspirational. I mean, this is what it's about for him. He doesn't want to be in that role in media arts. It's how we can step up and face the challenge for the 21st century. So that's, you know, and we have a fantastic dean as well, who came in a couple of years ago and has just allowed us to explore these different opportunities and is part of it. I mean, he really understands the need to focus on the students as opposed to the faculty and the students' experience. So by providing this opportunity, we ultimately benefit, you know, the students, and that's what it's about.
Yeah, so then they're kind of creating a portfolio of their own when they go on to do whatever it is that they end up after they graduate, right?
Right, exactly. So I guess, you know, to answer that second part of the question, if I look at what instructional designers need, perhaps more so these days, it's those kind of applied skills, the technical skills. It's good to be able to have institutional knowledge and understand, you know, how departments work and how the university works, and be able to kind of operate in a professional manner at those kinds of levels. But if I were hiring, I would look for someone who is able to use, you know, the creative suite from Adobe pretty extensively, including animation or a computer science background. So a combination of media design, and then the computer science knowledge, and of course then the educational instructional design, systems design understanding would be the perfect trifecta.
Right. So that comes in when the students I'm working with, they went out and found clients to do instructional projects. Mm-hmm. And so we did kind of have really almost two paths within the group. There were those that were doing what I would consider traditional instructional design work, when you're doing a needs analysis and mm-hmm. helping them come up with instructional strategies and write up an instructional design plan. And then there were others that actually did what I would consider more the development side, which mm-hmm. gets into what you're talking about, knowing the tools and the technology. Mm-hmm. And then I totally agree the whole applied piece of it. It's one thing to know all that, but then to be able to put it together and as you were saying, work with a real life, you guys, as a real life client to be able to, you know, take the needs and your skills and then bring it together.
We're just, Jen, in the process of trying to pass a master's in applied online technologies. It's a fully online degree, but it's with Faculty Senate just now. But the idea would be to have, you know, a cohort of around 20, 25 students involved in an interdisciplinary computer science, media arts, education, and business because of the project management dimension.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't even mention project management. Yeah, that ties into the consulting piece. Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, a different audience than your typical, you know, focused on higher ed or K-12, if you're at a school of education, it's common to focus on that. But right. It's really those individuals that could be of use to the military, could be of use in business, in Microsoft or wherever, perhaps those that would end up in instructional technology. But much more of a combination of that and less on the theory of instructional design, mm-hmm. which is important, but more of an applied focus.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to ignore the folks over in the chat room. Robert mentioned he's having difficulty reading it, so I'm kind of going back through. It's very active. Peggy and Carol are going, they're having a nice conversation, separate little mini webcasts on their own, so thank you. I'll have to go back through. Mm-hmm. I can't read and talk at the same time, but there were a few questions that came through, and I see them from Peggy, and I think she's referring to Carol's comments, but maybe also back to you. I think she was asking in terms of your program. It's a traditional program, but your courses would not be open in that I can't log in and take one of your classes without being an enrolled student, right?
That's right. I did run a little exception last summer where I opened up a education across cultures course I was teaching to participation, and we did have some people join. I think Peggy might have crossed Peggy's mind at some point, but okay. And it's not typically the case. And the biggest constraint for us would be that our current learning management system doesn't allow open access, so we'd have to run it on a separate system or manually enroll those students. And when you get up into the thousands, then that's a painful job for anyone.
Right. Well, and that gets into what you were talking about before. If you kind of give the professor the opportunity to work through the whole process, there may be, as you're saying, one-off opportunities to have maybe a synchronous session that would be open or something like that.
Yeah.
that you see it as well. And then I think Peggy was also wanting you to confirm, so the system you're using right now is Moodle, right, your LMS?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And any words of wisdom and why you chose it and is it working and what do you like and not like about it?
We're actually hosted with Moodle Rooms, which is now owned by Blackboard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we moved to Moodle, or a hosted version of Moodle, because it was time to move off Blackboard.
Yeah.
And now we're back there again.
And now you're back.
But yeah, Moodle Rooms have been a decent group to work with. They, you know, they're a newer company, and so, you know, there's been times where things haven't worked as well as we would have liked them to have worked, but they've always kind of managed to partner with us to come up with a solution, and so we keep working with them, and we're happy enough to extend our contract for the next 3 years. So.
Okay. And so the original decision was also based on them doing the kind of the back room of it as well, like the... Is that versus you just hosting your own Moodle on your own servers?
Exactly. That definitely a major consideration given our kind of physical infrastructure at the university. But we're mandated by law every 10 years in Montana to review our contracts, and the 10 years was up with Blackboard. And then we interviewed faculty, we surveyed them, we looked at different learning management systems, we looked at Sakai, we looked at Moodle, we looked at Blackboard again. There weren't quite the there wasn't Instructure and other, you know,
right.
LMSs around at that time. But you know, we looked at those options, and Moodle seemed to be the best fit. And then having it outsourced in terms of the hosting side of things worked real well as well with Moodle Room. So it's been good. The uptime has been good, which ultimately people need to know that their system is going to be there. And then, you know, the system is the system, whether it's Blackboard, Moodle, whatever. It's about how to use that to create that experience. And I mean, whether you bring in other tools, whether they're Web 2 or you decide to do, you know, just some different applications outside of that, you can work with what you've got to come up with something pretty
cool. Same thing. We use Blackboard. I consider it our home base where if we kind of get lost because I throw out a bunch of other tentacles out there with Google Docs or whatever it is we're using, I kind of bring everybody back. That's where they know to go look for the announcements and if I have anything important, and I post the recordings of our synchronous sessions, things like that. So everybody gets all hot and bothered about, oh, LMS, it's the death of online learning or whatever. It's not cool enough. Well, at the end of the day, it's a home base and it's like a classroom. It's not very sexy, but you gotta have it. It's gotta be where you all end up.
Well, and again, it's I mean, from a student's perspective, it's nice to know where to go and not to have to travel everywhere else. I think Howard Rheingold came up with a model where he realized that it just didn't work to have people all over the web, and so he got some grant funding to come up with a system that was that kind of more collaborative, you know, social media type experience, but all integrated into a more LMS type experience. And that's where, you know, LMSs continue to develop too, so you do have that more collaborative kind of feel, but there's not one perfect tool.
No, there's not. And I think there's something to be said for appreciating that kind of the sanctity of the class. I don't know if that's the right word, but there should be a safe environment. So I love the idea of throwing students out to the world and getting different perspectives in a wider network. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, when you're testing out something you're not comfortable with and you're throwing out theories and making up your own ideas that you have never thought haven't thought through and have never come up with, it's kind of nice to have that closed little environment at times just to keep it a safe spot. For example, in our class this semester, I'm having the students do a project management blog where they're talking about how things are going on their project. And I know they wouldn't want to have it out on the open internet because they're talking about their clients and talking about some of the resistance they're facing, things like that. And so it's nice to have and here I sound like I'm selling Blackboard or selling an LMS, but I think sometimes it kind of gets tossed out as all negative. But
So do you have open online courses? And you're at Old Dominion, is that?
I'm at Old Dominion, so ours is the traditional class. And I saw an email came through this week. I'm sure every university across the world right now, they're having some symposium on MOOCs and kind of like you said at the beginning, what to make of them and is it something that they could somehow incorporate into what we're doing. So I think everyone's just trying to get their head around. And then there are those of us that were down. When I think of a MOOC, I think more back what 2008 MOOCs.
Exactly. Yeah, different approach altogether. And you know, I've attended a couple of webinars with people who are, you know, fairly senior at our institution, and it's all been the kind of ex-MOOC discussion. So, I mean, it's just about having that conversation, and I'm glad that this is focused them on this area. The point that we've made is we've got a lot to do in terms of our current courses as opposed to taking one of them and putting them out there for the world. That, you know, really it comes down to quality above everything, and how do you build that meaningful experience for those students? An area that I don't think is given enough attention, and we're all very busy, is assessment. How do you
assessment's
do
huge.
Good yeah. assessment? Yeah.
I was thinking about that earlier today. I think it's Emporia State, I think, is doing that. They have a project management MOOC for instructional designers. Mm-hmm. And so I started taking it, and I kind of lurk on some of those just to see how they're being run. And it's being run by instructional designers, a great group of people, but it appears he's doing all the assessments. So he's got a bunch of project. It's a project-based class where he's asking you to contemplate a project you're working on and run through the steps of the project management process. Yeah. And I think he's grading it like you would a traditional class, which that you just there just aren't enough hours in the day. And
right.
I think that's the piece, unless you do quizzes or you do some, I've seen everyone's looking now in these automated ways to look at essays, to score essays.
Mm.
You know, I'm not sure that's the way either. But I keep kind of going back to this idea. I think there's value in it if we look at it for what it where the value is. And then the value is, I think, is rather than us all going out and replicating content, you use it as a content repository or going, you know, use the video, well-produced videos, use the well-produced whatever the content is, but then wrap around it the instructional piece, which, as you're saying, takes a tremendous amount of effort to do well, particularly in the assessment piece. And I think that's kind of the now you got me on my MOOC soapbox. I'm not an all or nothing kind of person, but I think that unfortunately, looking at it as though it's this huge disruptive thing that's going to change higher education is probably not not appropriate either.
Yeah.
I'm trying to follow along here. Carol had some questions that I'm not sure I'm following, and they may have to make another text chat post to help me understand it. She said she'd like to know Robert's perspective on the science and arts integration. Does that mean something to you?
Well, I think that is how it should be. You know, the more that we can do to get out of academic silos and collaborating around those bigger questions that we all have to face today, you know, take global warming as an issue, that there's a scientific response and there's an artistic response to that, and being able to leverage the best of both of those, I think, is key. I mean, one way you could do it potentially would be, and this might be a more applied kind of piece, through some data visualization, bringing the creativity of a designer to the data that's available, I think would be one potential interdisciplinary cross there. When it comes to those kind of things, I think Michael Wesch is a wonderful inspiration. I think many of you are familiar with Michael's work with the Machine Is Using Us. It's a few years old now, but what's really great about him is, one, he makes things into these stories that are compelling, that make us understand once more the humanity of this and the fact that at the end of the day, we're all traveling through space on a planet. And, you know, when you get outside of these things and get to the bigger issues and look at those, you know, problems from that perspective, then I think that you can come up with new solutions. So the more that we can get outside of our little kind of areas, the better.
So you did answer her question. I didn't know what she meant. So great job. You took that one. I kind of grabbed it from the middle of the text chat, so it was out of context. But it sounds like from what she's posted after you started speaking, I think you were on the right track with what she was talking about. So
there's some good stuff on transdisciplinarity that there's a fair deal of interest in. Our president has the Global Leadership Initiative, which encourages that stepping out of different areas and considering those big questions. So he's definitely on the right track with that.
Excellent. Well, perfect. So, Robert, in the last couple minutes we've got, I know you're at home today, so we're stealing away from your time away from work, but where do you see your next challenge coming? As you said, you've got the accessibility issues that you're working on, and what else is around the corner that you're interested in?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I guess I'm personally interested in seeing what can be done to create a learning experience that is really focused on assessment, and not assessment as in an algorithm to assess it, but personal assessment by the instructor, but that the students are given as much autonomy as possible. So essentially, you create a framework in which they can engage with the content and potentially the connections that might exist to help them. But ultimately, they're responsible for producing work and get that personal feedback when they need it from their instructor. So I think it's a combination of a self-paced approach with the ability to leverage external networks to be able to do that yourself, but get that personalized attention when you need it by someone who's able to kind of push you forward. So I'm not sure exactly what that's going to look like.
No, I am so with you, and I've said it different ways, and Peggy's kind of making fun. She said learning experiences focused on assessment. It does sound kind of funny, but I totally see. And I kind of equate it to we have to have more tailored and guided learner practice, which then requires then some type of, when you say it's a guided learner practice, you need to be able to embed with it the assessment piece and the guidance mm-hmm. and the feedback for what they're doing. And mm-hmm. and to me, that it's all tied together. It's not like, okay, do this activity and then I have an assessment, that there needs to somehow be a way that it's a relevant activity to what they're hopefully going to somehow apply this skill mm-hmm. or knowledge that they're using in a context that's relevant to the student, and at the same time provides them with relevant feedback and mm-hmm. So that they can take whatever they're trying to do to the next level. And I think that's the way I tend to just, and I think you and I are basically.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Tying it to some competency-based aspect, I think is probably part of it as well. So rather than, I don't know. I like the idea of being able to demonstrate how that experience is played out by their real world applications.
Absolutely, yeah. And that you know, it's kind of the Designers for Learning focus of this whole webcast. Was just the whole idea was to kind of move down this path of the realistic application of things. And Carol's asking a question. Do you envision that there would be room then for peer and self assessment within that too? Or
absolutely, absolutely. Whatever will benefit those students, but they should have the choice. If peer assessment works for them, great. If it doesn't, they should have the choice to do that work individually and take out that kind of power dynamic of needing to, you know, complete things along a certain time frame and get them graded at a certain level, but more this is the work that I'm doing, I'm engaged, and I'm getting the personalized feedback I need to move myself to the next level. Mm-hmm. We started talking about that consulting role with faculty. Students should have that opportunity to have a consultant with them on their learning experiences. They need to have the ability to access the learning as it's most effective to them. And so that learning environment should be hyper designed. It should be fantastic and have numerous options. But there's also that individual that's there. Mm-hmm. there to help them.
And I think, too, as you get closer to embedding it into a real-life context, the assessment is almost self-evident. It either works or it doesn't work. And I'm not saying you need to shoot off a rocket to tell if it works or not, but let's take something that, more, say you're taking a knitting class.
Well,
if you're supposed to be making a scarf and suddenly it doesn't look anything like a scarf, it's like, whoops, there's something I didn't do well.
You know, an example would be educational research, and this is the course that I would be thinking about doing this with. The proof would be in the pudding, mm-hmm. as opposed to it writing about the ideas or knowing about, you know, certain things, that you would actually be able to conduct that in some shape or form. I mean, let's just do some research. It's not that,
Right.
It's difficult.
Go on and try.
Yeah, it's difficult, but it's okay,
Yeah. Yeah, we had a section this semester on doing an analysis and data collection, and the students were very befuddled by it. And I'm like, well, just go try it. You know, if you wanted to see if what this person does, you know, a task analysis, sit there and watch them. You know, they're like, really? Like, yeah, you just go watch them, and then you'll decide what checklists work well for you and what questions work well, and
right.
the amount of time it takes to get a comprehensive view of what they do. And, you know, it's just, you got to do it. You just have to try it. And,
yeah. You know, Jen, I know that you're very interested in the service learning and experiential learning side of things. So I did ask around a little at our university in terms of what's being done. Mm-hmm. And we have an academic enrichment program. And so there's a lot of service learning opportunities that happens through our academic enrichment group, but it really comes down to the faculty and the departments and what they value in terms of service learning or experiential learning. Mm-hmm. And the one group in particular that I chatted with was Communicative Sciences and Disorders, and they have a speech-language pathology program. It's a graduate and undergraduate program, and they have an interesting kind of hybrid model. They deliver it live at a distance for some students, and some students are present in the class, you know, which has, it becomes an interesting pedagogical challenge in itself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the work that they do, I think, is just fantastic. They have their students go out and do nursing kind of screenings. They do Indian health education. But their program's kind of competency-based. So the individuals are expected in the graduate program to come out having hit certain competencies, and apparently they're quite robust, and there's a number of them. So they have multiple things that they must select to do across a semester in terms of service learning components, and there's multiple things that they can choose to do, because it's, you know, more their interests or more where they plan to be. But they do a kids' fair, they do literacy screenings at schools. The trick as ever, I guess, in those types of approaches is coordinating and organizing. They have 60 graduate students in that program, and the faculty are responsible for placing those students and making sure that their requirements and their personal pathways are taken into account. But that's a nice example of a distance learning blended approach with some service learning components.
That's an awesome example. And yeah, as you're saying, the back to your comments before, the embedding the practice and the assessment together, that's a ton of work. It sounds like 60 students, and I'm sure it's not a one-to-one ratio, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
But somebody's got to make sure that as they're going out there, they're with an organization that makes sense for what they're going to do to try to gain these skills, and then right. that they're actually doing it, and that they're getting the feedback that's required. That's awesome. That's really... So do you see more moving that direction as you're kind of polling people and talking to them, or is that kind of an outlier at this stage?
No, you know, I think you think that speech language pathology, where you have to work closely with, you know, students and understand who they are and have that practicum component. I know that the counseling education program is similar. I think for those that see that as being part of their core program, it's there. There's definitely an understanding. There's definitely a need for more of that. And I think if from some of the conversations that we've had with local businesses and what that they're looking for, to have individuals that they know are going to have the skills to come out and be employed at a
exactly.
at a company.
You're getting a sneak peek at some talent, right?
Yeah, exactly. there should be more, but again, you know, it is driven by the faculty in particular departments, and some departments are more kind of attuned into that aspect than others, and some are more, you know, tuned into online than others. I think the real benefit and the real change we're starting to see is that a blended approach, an approach that allows students to engage in their own time with the content that they need, and then using more kind of hands-on, problem-based, authentic type of activities in class, I think it's going to lead people to be thinking, oh, okay, how do I extend this authenticity and you know, begin to reach out and touch on the community as well. So I'm optimistic because we're going to start moving in that way fairly heavily, I think.
Yeah, like I said a couple minutes ago, I just see it as an evolution that you, when you first get your hands on a tool like an LMS, what's the thing? You know, you've got a hammer, so everything looks like a nail or whatever. So it's like, I've got an LMS, so that must mean how I have to teach everything in the LMS. Well, yeah, that's part of it, but then you can continue to do all these things that you know work really well.
Right.
In
exactly.
The world. So, you know, don't forget what you knew before about teaching and design.
Yeah, I mean, it's important that something works. When you press a button, you want that thing to do what it's supposed to do, and if it doesn't, it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. But that misses the entire point of the experience once more.
It's a tool.
How do we think about this? How do we create, given what is available today, the best possible learning experience for students, and there's a world of opportunities there.
Yeah.
And what's encouraging about MOOCs, Jen, is that I think you know, it does allow people to think outside of the institution. And,
oh yeah.
And you've worked with Alec Kouros and but that idea of thinning the walls of the classroom and just helping people understand that, you know, in order for students to be successful today, they need to be connected and be able to connect with individuals who have the experience and the expertise and knowledge to help them when they need it. And I think that that's one of the things that all of these people engaged all of the time creates a much more active learning ecosystem out there and a much more germane area for people to tap into. So.
Oh, and yeah. Also, I totally, absolutely agree that it extends the learning outside, you know, the walls of an institution, and then also just the idea that you control your destiny in life. So there are all these classes. If I wanted to learn how to be an engineer and I really wanted to apply myself, I could do it. There are enough classes out there that I could go and get pretty well on my way towards some new career. Mm-hmm. Which my nephew's actually doing right now. He's contemplating going back to a master's program. So he's taking MOOCs for that reason, just trying to get understanding of what that field is like, whatever it is he's looking at. And that's different. You know, that's not how we used to – when I graduated high school, you picked your major, and then that's what
exactly.
You were, and that was your career path. And it just opens up a lot of doors for people. So, no
yeah. –
You're right. I'm trying to drive down the middle of the road, not trying to go on either side.
Yeah. No, I think I'm very interested in what Harvard are doing. Harvard and MIT with edX. You can keep Coursera. I don't think the quality's there, and that's not their focus. But Harvard with their edX approach. I had an opportunity to listen to their CIO talk a little about it, and I was very impressed. It's basically trying to figure out how learning is going to be within the next 5 years, and that includes on-campus and off-campus and the integration of digital technology in the learning experience, and that's what it's about. And yes, you know, it might be through leveraging the information that they get through online participation that they can better create face-to-face campus experiences as well, but at least they're focused on that. They're pretty good, those guys.
Yeah, I haven't taken any there. I've lurked in some Coursera courses, and I was part of. They were the one that had the kind of famous one that blew up, I think, right? That they stopped in the middle.
The Coursera
learning.
One, yeah.
Yeah,
I
think so. And I really can't. I haven't done enough to evaluate. I just lurk. I just kind of like to see what's going on. I don't devote enough time to really say. Well, I'll let you go. This is we're coming in on an hour,
I keep
and
you
I
feel... on. I don't know. I just keep talking.
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
So
keep
nice
talking.
To it's so nice to catch up with you, Jen. It really is. It's been far too long.
Yeah, and I think the first time we met was actually at a real life. It's kind of opposite. Usually, I meet people online, and then I have the opportunity to meet face to face. But I think we were down at a. Was it in Florida or something? We were at a AECT.
It was Kentucky.
Kentucky, yeah.
Yeah, and I think I hunted you out to help
You
me
were
with
you were
that.
my only person in the audience. It's like one. I'm like, are you sure you're in the right room? There's no one. It's like crickets, and then you
Yeah.
were.
Well, this is great. I caught a couple of your shows as well. It's always interesting to hear other people talk
Well,
about
feel
these kinds
free
of
to
ideas.
come on back, because this is, I just want to keep continuing the,
Sure.
variation on a theme here, and kind of continue the conversation on instructional design down this path.
Yeah.
So.
Well, maybe we could get Marlene on and we can talk some more about the accessibility and universal design for learning side of things that we've been.
Definitely. Oh, and keep me informed on what's going on in your the program. You said that you're kicking off in the instructional design piece.
Yeah,
So that's
we're
cool.
just batting that one around again because it's just one that we all need to kind of look at and what tends to fly under the radar.
Sounds good. Well, have a great weekend, Robert,
You
and thank
too.
you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks to everybody. I'm sorry if I missed questions, but Robert,
Eddie,
maybe when you're
Carol, others, thank you.
yeah, and maybe
Nice to
when
be with
you're
you all.
when we're done here, Robert, and you have access, you can come back and check the Titan pad out
I
and see
will
what the
do.
questions are, because you can
Great.
always add your comments later. So,
Okay.
okay,
Well,
thanks, guys.
see
Talk to you
you.
later. Have a great week.